Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Every country, every culture, you could argue, has a founding myth, you know, a story to give a hue of legitimacy. Say, in this country, the idea of American exceptionalism. Now, we can debate whether that's true in this country, but in China, the founding myths are declared and laid out by the ruling Communist Party. There is hardly any public debate, except for a small group of rebel writers and artists and filmmakers. And there's a new book out about them. It's called Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. And the author is with us. Pulitzer Prize winner Ian Johnson has written in and about China for decades for the Wall Street Journal, for the New York Review of Books. He's now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Ian, it's great to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be on the show.
So let's talk about the Communist Party in China and what you call its obsession with history. I mean, I recall from my time reporting in China, hearing officials and others talking about history that is correct or history that is incorrect. For Xi Jinping, you know, how is his declared version of history a tool to be in power and stay in power?
As you said, history is important in every country. In the United States, we're still debating issues like the centrality of slavery. In China, it's really no different, except that it's so central to the Communist Party's claim to rule China. According to the party, China was laid low in the 19th century, but it was only the Communist Party that was able to put China back on its feet and make it prosperous and even feared as a military power. That has been the central message of the Communist Party since it founded the People's Republic in 1949. But under Xi Jinping, when he took power in 2012, he felt that there were too many people questioning the party who had said, well, since 1949, there's been a series of crises, the world's worst recorded famine, endless political turmoil, massacre in downtown Beijing, ethnic strife, et cetera, et cetera. So Xi Jinping, one of his signature policies was to regain control of history. And so he did that right in 2012 when he took power. His first public appearance was at this big exhibition that reaffirmed the party's control, or the party's story. In 2013, he said, you can't really criticize the Mao era, and on and on. In 2021, he issued this big resolution, which essentially rewrote the history of the People's Republic and told people what the correct interpretation is. So it's been one of these things that's been an obsession of his really for over a decade now.
You know, for Americans listening, there's one section where you bring up Colonial Williamsburg in my state of Virginia. Now, over time, Americans have, as you've described, learned about the framers and their warts, their slave owning. They realized Colonial Williamsburg might have been a little Disney-ish, and visitor numbers went down. Whereas in China, there's a whole industry called red tourism, and visitors go to a place called Yan'an, middle of nowhere, where, you know, as the story goes, the early Communist Party in the 1930s makes these heroic plans to unite China under socialism. So when you kind of compare Williamsburg and Yan'an, what's the difference here?
Yeah, I mean, Williamsburg was started as a program to celebrate kind of the founding ideals of the United States. And as people began to have a more nuanced understanding of American history, people began to question it. But in Yan'an, which is where the communists holed up in World War II, it was their wartime base up in this mountainous area, very arid mountain area. The mythic story there is that this is where this hardy band of brothers sort of got their forces together, helped defeat the Japanese, and then rode to victory on the back of a popular uprising. But as Chinese counter historians show, it was quite a different place. And I think this is what the party really objects to. They don't want you questioning anything like these kind of myths.
But what you do is you profile so many of these counter-historians, as you describe them, Ian. Your book titled Spark refers to a journal that I want to ask you about. These writers in the late 50s write about China's horrific famine. You know, at least 40 million people died, as you started to talk about. I mean, it's a complicated story, abject management of the country by Mao Zedong. But as far as human suffering, tell us a little bit what the Spark writers chronicled, because the outside world had no idea.
Yeah, they were sent out to this remote area of China. They were part of a politically persecuted group of people who were called rightists because they were considered not left enough, not communist enough. There they saw the Great Famine that claimed up to 45 million people, and they thought that we have to let people know about this. So they got their hands on a mimeograph machine, and they made a journal that talked about the problems. Where did this famine come from? And they identified issues back then in 1960 that are very current today, and mainly the problems of one-party rule, that there are no checks and balances. It's sort of roughshod authoritarianism. They published this journal. It was pretty quickly closed down, but it was rediscovered in the 1990s, and they got the two surviving issues. They had photos of it, and they just made PDFs, and people started to email it to each other. And they said, look at this, people 35, 40 years ago are making stuff that is current today. So it became sort of a sensation among public intellectuals in China. Somebody made a big documentary film about it.
Yeah, and I benefited from it. I watched one of the films in English. It's called The Ditch, about famine in a prison labor camp. And right around the time my own grandfather lived and died in a prison labor camp in that part of China, in Qinghai, in northwestern China. I mean, just to warn the listener that one of the films depicts grim, grotesque realities of people starving, of cannibalism. But for these counter-historians, I mean, they're the ones who help these stories survive. Yeah, I guess many of them talk about having a responsibility to history.
They see this as, in a way, a time capsule that they're sending off to future Chinese people to let them know that today, inside China, there are people who are trying to document Chinese history. And many of them see it as almost like their patriotic duty. One person told me, we have to be able to tell our own history. So I think that this is this kind of calling that they have. There's no money in this. There's no fame. But it is a calling.
Yeah. And I wonder how you felt kind of interacting with that. There was one person, when I was researching my own family history, my dad and I came upon, who worked in these labor camps. He knew about the famine. He drew us a map of where all the labor camps were. And he said, you know, this stuff has never been published before. And then he said, I have this responsibility to history. I wonder if you ran into that a lot. People, not always important people, who felt like, you know, I do need to write this down for people who are going to come after me.
Yeah, there is something very much that comes through over and over again. I think this is one of these universal human feelings or ideas, which is justice and trying to tell the truth. One person I profiled, Tan He Cheng, he went down to southern Hunan province and chronicled a massacre that had taken place there. He was later not allowed to publish it, and he felt that he owed it to the people he interviewed, to the survivors, to publish this. And he said, they said I couldn't publish it. That's their problem. I knew I was going to publish it. And he made it his life's work.
As far as hope, there is some of it at the end of your book. And you write, as China's economy starts to slow down, it will not grow at the pace it used to. More people will start to face hardship and maybe ask questions. Do you think it may stoke a kind of a demand from the public for alternative narratives of what's happening in China?
Yeah, I think that the past 30, 40 years have been an amazing period of time in China for economic growth. And that when you have an average economic growth rate of 9%, that papers over a lot of cracks in society, a lot of tensions, a lot of problems. But as growth slows and we have chronic problems such as youth unemployment, demographic challenges, these are things that are going to be real issues in China in the coming decades, you're going to have people who are wondering about the party's successes in running the country and who are looking for alternative histories. This is something we saw with the COVID protests, that last year in 2022, 2021, there was an outpouring of people with alternative explanations for what happened in China. And some of the people I profiled in the book really rose to prominence in China for having other explanations. And that was really quite an interesting. So if we think of the COVID protests not as an outlier, but as a harbinger of change, that could be a sign of where China's going.
The book is Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. And the author is Ian Johnson, Pulitzer Prize winner. Ian, so good to have you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.